Love Sport Radio. On digital radio, online, mobile, and smart speaker. This is Upfront on Love Sport.
You're listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. You can listen to me live every weekday from 1:30 p.m. on Love Sport Radio, on DAB Digital, online, or on your Alexa smart speaker. And if you're listening to the podcast, do leave us a rating and a review on iTunes, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Love Sport.
And I wanted to look back at that brilliant playoff final yesterday. Perhaps not quite as dramatic as we've been used to with playoff finals. I said sort of jokingly, they're always 1-0. They very often are 1-0, but so often a very dramatic one. Maybe yesterday was a little bit less dramatic because Villa were quite so dominant, but it was nevertheless an impressive performance from Aston Villa, and specifically from their two Villa fans at the helm, Dean Smith and Jack Grealish. And it's not often that you see people living out their exact childhood dream in sport. Maybe in Grealish's own dreams, it would have been the Champions League trophy or the Premier League trophy that he was lifting while wearing a Villa shirt and a Villa captain's armband. But, you know, you get the idea. It was a dream moment, the kind of thing that messing around in the garden or lying in bed at night Grealish would have dreamt of as an eight-year-old. I've no doubt about that. And yesterday was not far off it. He's a lifelong Villa fan. He probably bleeds claret and blue if you bother to check. Actually, we can check because he grazed his eyebrow on the trophy yesterday and sliced it open. No treatment required, says his manager, but still rather amusing that he managed to cut himself on the trophy. And that's the kind of boyishness that we kind of love about Jack Grealish, or what all Villa fans love anyway. Did anyone see the Villa result coming? Were they the favourites? Yeah, they absolutely were. And I think rightly so, because the form they've been on has been quite remarkable. I don't know if I predicted a Villa victory. I certainly was close. Did I predict a Villa win? Yeah, I'm pretty sure I did. Yeah, absolutely. I'm taking credit for that. Picking up another crucial point in the predictions league. How close was my prediction, Ben? Obviously, Villa are massively the form team going into this game. You know, the winning run they've been on in the Championship, the way they came through the playoffs was pretty efficient as well. I thought West Brom got close to them. They hit the bar. They might have had a penalty as well. You know, with the breakfast producer is a West Brom fan. He spent most of the morning complaining about how they could have beaten them and made it through to the final. It's hard to look beyond Aston Villa because of that. You know, that midfield, Jack Grealish and John McGinn, is so difficult to bet against because McGrealish has the creativity, he runs the show with the ball, and you've got John McGinn doing the terrier work in midfield. Add to that the goal scorers they've got, Tammy Abraham, Jonathan Codger. I have to go with Aston Villa, I think. This game is always 1-0. I think something like 9 of the last 14 Championship playoff finals have been 1-0, so I've got to go 1-0 Aston Villa. Yeah, close. No cigar on the result, but nevertheless got the right winner. And, you know, Grealish was obviously at the forefront of the celebration. He was also at the forefront of the performance. Not literally, but certainly he was important in everything that happened. He set the tone. He was diligent. He dropped back as he needed to repeatedly to maintain that shape that Aston Villa had, avoid getting sprung upon by Derby on the counter. And that's kind of where Jack Grealish is at the moment. He's matured into a player and a man. 4 years ago, we saw the wrong side of Grealish's boyishness. You know, that youth that we love about him. He was pictured inhaling what they insist calling hippie crack. It's just laughing gas in a balloon. I don't know who came up with the term hippie crack, but they should be shot. Or that picture of him passed out on a lad's holiday on the street. They were bad looks for a young lad just making his way in the professional game. And he was exactly that, young, and he still has that youth about him. But 4 years later, he's a much more mature man. Through all the moments he's been through this year, the change of management, they were 13th at the start of March. He thought he was leaving back in August. Of course, the Birmingham fan who threw a punch at him as well. He scored twice against Blues. He was proudly saying that in his post-match press conference, saying, yeah, I've scored twice against Blues and got promoted. That's pretty much the perfect season. And there's so much to fall in love with about Jack Grealish. He was wearing a pair of boots that were quite literally falling apart yesterday. You know, the outside layer had peeled off his left boot. Thank goodness it was his left boot and not his right one. But nevertheless, it was because he had worn them his first game back from injury, got a couple of assists, and they'd become his lucky boots. And there's something so brilliantly 1990s about that. So romantic about it. Wears a pair of child shin pads because he thinks it gives him better feel on the pitch. He's absolutely mad for football and he's mad for the club. You can imagine him being that kid who got blisters on blisters and muddy knees until it got dark every night of the week as a kid. Because that's the kind of person he is. And there isn't a lot of that in modern football. You think about, I don't know, Manchester United's born and bred man, Jesse Lingard, with all of his hand signals and personalised logo and weird fake glasses. Or Jack Wilshere and how little he seems to enjoy football for the majority of his career. They're so removed from a game that we all know and love. But players like Grealish or like Raheem Sterling or even James Milner to a slightly different extent, they all make us feel like people, like we're just watching people living out their dream. And that's what football's all about. And in Grealish's case, he's doing it alongside another man who is also living out his dream. Dean Smith, he's third generation Villa. His grandfather was a massive Villa fan. His dad, who I know he gets very emotional about because he's struggling with dementia, but he's a Villa fan. His dad would take him to the home games and his mum would drive the two of them to the away games. The fans have not always been in love with the club. Let's not forget that 4 years ago, you know, about the same time Grealish was out partying in Malaga, the Villa fans were spending the first 8 minutes of the game on the concourse, leaving the whole tent empty as protest against what the club were doing to themselves, what Paul Lambert was doing to the team. It's unthinkable that Premier League ever-presence would be protesting against their own club, and of course it led to relegation eventually. But now, it's almost as though they've had a fan takeover. This fan consortium of Jack Grealish and Dean Smith at the helm of the club have taken them back to the Premier League. It might not have been a deliberate or even a boardroom takeover, but a takeover nevertheless. They've got Villa fans believing again, and it means that it brings one of England's great old grounds back into the Premier League and in a United state.
Love Sport.
Promotion back to the Premier League for Aston Villa. It was a magical day for all Villa fans, I'm sure, and everyone involved with the club. Let's see what Alan Evans, a European Cup winner with Villa, has to say about it. Alan, obviously you must still be on cloud nine, I'd have thought.
Yeah, I'm delighted. I sat and watched it at home and I was delighted to see what happened. They've been trying hard for the last few years to get back into the Premiership. And now they've achieved that, and rightly so, I believe. I think they have deserved it. So it's all about what goes on from here now and how they progress and how they manage to stabilise themselves in the Premiership, because that's what they'll have to try and do.
Has it been quite difficult for someone like you, who obviously you were there in the real glory days at Aston Villa, to then see the club struggle in the way that they have over that period which led to them getting relegated?
Well, I'm always of great belief that you get what you deserve in football. And I think that the club, with the greatest respect to the club, they made some bad decisions on the appointments they made over the years. And that's obviously been, I think that's been obvious to many people now. And the important person at that club, obviously, is obviously the chairman and then your manager. And the management has to be right. The management team have to be right. And having gone through, I don't know, probably four or five, possibly even six managers over the last few years, it's a case of they had to get it right. They have to get it right sometime. I think in this case, they certainly got it right in the form of Ken Smith, who, let's be honest, has done it. He's done his apprenticeship at Walsall and Brentford. And when this position opened, it was a case of what we're talking about. And obviously, he's a Villa man through and through. He's Villa fans, and you've really got someone who's hungry to do well for the club, because it's his club. And I think it was a fantastic appointment, whoever made that appointment. And I think it's got its rewards now.
I wonder, Alan, because I know that you obviously spent a long time at the club. And as I mentioned there, you won the European Cup in 1982, obviously. Mm. But you were also there when Villa were relegated to the second tier and, of course, helped them come back up. I wonder if you saw any similarities or what was it? To bounce straight back up was obviously a massive achievement.
Yeah, the similarities were that they appointed the right manager. That's basically the similarities. I mean, when having won the European Cup, our players or the players were decimated as far as rid of them. They got rid of so many players so quickly after the European Cup final. Mm. It was always going to be a problem.
Yeah.
And because of that, we slumped in the league. We had trouble. We got, again, the wrong management in. And then they made the right appointment in Graham Taylor. And we came and bounced back right away. And it was important that you do that if you can bounce back straight away.
Yeah.
Villa didn't do that in this case, but I think that's because they had the wrong appointments, to be honest. So
yeah.
It's similar in that way. It's similar in that way. They got the right management team in. And it's not just about the manager. It's about his back staff, you know. You've got Richard Kelly there and obviously John Terry, who John Terry has done it all, done it at the highest level. So that's a great bonus for the club. Richard Kelly is going to be very important to Dean Smith because he's a right-hand man and trust him implicitly. So you've got the right management team at the moment. And it's possible, it's important rather, that they stay together. And then it's a real test coming up because if I look at the team right now, as it's right now and the team that played yesterday, I'm just wondering how many of those players are going to be able to handle the Premier League when you're up against the Manchester City's, Liverpool's, and the Chelsea, Arsenal, Man United of this world. That's going to be the real test. So, massive amount of work to be done during the summer. I'm sure Dean will not shirk that. I'm sure he'll go for that. And now it's up to see whether the club can back him from a financial aspect and give him that opportunity to stabilise it into the Premiership, because that's what's really important.
I was talking earlier there, Alan, about Jack Grealish and obviously the impact he's had. Him, a Villa fan, Villa captain, alongside Dean Smith, another Villa fan. What do you make of his kind of, you know, because he came onto the scene so young and we could all recognise his talent but also his flaws. What a maturation for the lad.
Well, yeah, a player of that age getting into the first team and being an important aspect to the team because, you know, he's a footballer. He's just an out-and-out footballer. Mm. He loves to play a game. He's one of these guys, I'm sure. I don't know him that well, Jack, but I'm sure that he'll be one of these people who loves just to play five sides all day.
Yeah.
Because he's got that talent, he's got that touch and feel. And you have to have people around him who can help. And there are times where Jack has really struggled, perhaps because he hasn't had the correct players around him. And the better players you get around him, the more he will come out of his shell and the more he will produce. So what I'm saying is that over the next couple of months, I'm sure there'll be quite a lot of changes at the club in personnel. And if you can get the right people in beside Jack, if Jack hopefully stays, and we all hope that, if you get the right people around him, then he can be even better next year. And it will be a real test for him next year in the Premier League. But he has the ability to handle that, I'm sure.
Do you think that Jack Grealish will one day outgrow Aston Villa? Do you think he is the kind of talent who just has to go and play Champions League football at a very high level at some point in his career?
Well, why not do that with Villa, his hometown, you know, his home club, if that's what the club can produce for him? So, you know, as far as Jack's concerned, he's got to produce the goods next year. As far as the club's concerned, they've got to back the manager to be able to produce the goods. So it's a two-way thing. Jack would love to be able to achieve with Aston Villa. There's no doubt about that. Is it going to be possible? Well, I think very early on in the Premier League season, we will find out. So this is a really important period of time over the next month or so, or 6 weeks, to see what kind of players are going to be able to bring in and what kind of changes they're going to make at the club as far as the personnel are concerned. But Jack, I'm sure, would love to do it at Aston Villa. Why should he go somewhere when he loves the club so much?
Mm.
And, you know, it's not just about Jack. I mean, Jack has had a good season. You could see when he was out, the results were not quite as good.
No.
And then when Jack came back, things started to be happening again. But, you know, you look at other players. I mean, I think the two centre-backs, Transebe and Tyrant Mings, has been outstanding.
Yeah. Yeah.
And I think that is a good partnership. Now, they're loan players. Are they going to go back to their clubs? Are they going to stay at Aston Villa? Are Villa going to buy them? I don't know. But if they don't, and they go back to their own clubs, they've got a big gap to fill. And who are they going to fill that with? I have no idea. So there's a massive amount of work to be done. And I'm sure they're already at it now.
Yeah. You mentioned centre-half pairings there. I was talking last week about the importance of two centre-halves who understand each other. Now, obviously, you have famously had a great relationship with Ken McNaught at Aston Villa. I wonder what makes those relationships so good? Is it just about playing together and repetition, understanding the other centre-half?
I would think so. I think you get to know each other very quickly. The fact that myself and Ken could speak to each other and be understood was probably a help. having both come from Scotland. But yeah, it's just this playing together, you know, the consistently playing together, even in training matches and training sessions. And once you get to know each other, you know each other's strengths and weaknesses. You know that if I missed it, he'd sort of be there covering me and vice versa. It's an understanding that comes with playing together. Mm. And it worked for us as a pair. And it has worked for, I think, Transavian Mings. But if they don't stay, my worry is that those guys will go back to their home clubs. Mm. And how does that leave Aston Villa then? They need to have a good pairing.
Yeah.
Because I don't see anyone coming through from the setup that is going to go into that situation and perform well or perform the level they've got to perform.
And of course,
because they're going to have to perform against the likes of Manchester City, Arsenal, and this is not easy. This is a tough league.
I mean,
Premier League.
I pity anyone who has to wake up in the morning and think, right, who have we got this afternoon? City, great, excellent. That'll be easy. Yeah, who'd be a defender, Alan?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and look at the quality. I mean, all these players who are the sort of at the very heights of the football, who are strikers, who are international strikers. These guys are top quality.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely.
And if you don't have a top quality, and I've always believed, and perhaps because I was a defender, I've always believed that the clubs that do well are the clubs that give nothing away.
Mm.
And give nothing away goal-wise. Don't give goals away. Win your games 1-0 or 2-0 or 2-1, but don't give silly goals away. And I've got to say, I went up a few times this year early on in the season and they gave a few silly goals away, unnecessary goals away. And that's so you always question that. But as it's gone on, it's tightened up. They've got Transavian Mings together and that just had a whole completely different complex on the issue.
Mm.
So I was delighted that they got together, and I think that's a big part of them going up.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I mean, they say in America, defence wins championships, and I quite agree
absolutely,
with them, apart
yeah.
from the pronunciation, obviously, and the spelling. Alan, thank you so much for coming on. I could talk to you all day about how important defending is, but time is catching up with us. Alan Evans there, who, of course, was a key centre-half in that Aston Villa European Cup winning side, but also went through a period of great turmoil at the club. You know, Alan was one of the guys who stayed after the European Cup, and then they were relegated 4 or 5 years later, and he stayed and helped them as captain get back up into the Premier League, in the first division as it was then, of course. But that's kind of the difference, I suppose. How many of those players got relegated from the Premier League and then stayed and brought the club back up? Not many, and you don't see it very often these days. But crucially, and this is the best point, I think, after they won the European Cup in 82, they dismantled the side very, very quickly. And that is, of course, what Graham Souness was famously criticised for doing with the Liverpool side that was so dominant in the 80s and all of a sudden not. Because initially, they didn't change an ageing side. You know, they kept the boot room around. And then they realised that they had to make some changes to the ageing side. And they did it all too quickly. Managed transition. It's what you have to do with teams. And boy, the history keeps making the same mistakes. Manchester United, Arsenal, Chelsea, Liverpool even, obviously, through for the last 30 years. You have to manage transition better than that.
This is Love Sport.
I want to talk about Frank Lampard. You mentioned there Mel Morris saying he was confident that he would hang on to Frank Lampard. Now, I don't think one season, you know, one swallow does not a summer make, famously. And I don't think that one season of Frank Lampard doing okay at Derby is going to convince many top chairmen that he's the man they need. But this is football, and quite often things are done the wrong way. Now, look at what Frank Lampard's actually achieved here. He has got a team to finish sixth again. That's kind of Derby's thing, finishing sixth. They've got, I think, one more point than last season. Their record was almost identical. They won the same number of games. They turned one defeat into a draw. So if you want to talk about improvement, has Frank Lampard improved Derby? Not massively. It's actually 1 point fewer, I'm being told now. 1 point fewer than last season, turning one draw into a defeat. So if anything, he's made them worse. All right, they're playing a better brand of football, and obviously they're in a better state budget-wise. But nevertheless, I don't think Frank Lampard has made that much progress at Derby. One thing he has done, and I will give him credit for this, because we talked about it with Dean Smith and Jack Grealish, is he's reconnected the fans in the club. And I know that Mel Morris will see that as hugely valuable, because Derby have a number of times found it... They've found their fans a long way from where they are, put it that way. And look, we'll speak to Mark Edworthy about this a little bit later on, but I don't think anyone at the club could deny that the fans haven't always been on side. And the Frank Lampard appointment was a bit of a risk in that sense, because in the end, he'd never been a manager before. And he was a big name, but realistically just a name. For all the respect in the game that people have got for him, and I have a huge amount of respect for Frank Lampard and what he's achieved, I've got a huge amount of respect for the 22 children's novels that he claims to have authored. You know, I really do. He's obviously scored a lot of goals. He's won a lot of trophies. But he hasn't got a managerial record to speak of. Before May 31st, 2018, when he got the Derby job, he had never been a football manager. And for all that you can say, oh, you don't have to have been a player to be a manager, so therefore vice versa, it's a big risk to take a bloke who's never had the top job at a football club and say, right, can you get us back into the Premier League, please? It's a massive risk. So, all credit to them. It's worked, I think, to a certain extent. He certainly hasn't flopped. The players have really responded to them. If I had to question Frank Lampard, I'd do it in two ways. One, there's a lack of plan B at Derby. You know, he picked an unusual team yesterday. It didn't work. With Mason Bennett leading the line, no recognised striker in the starting lineup, because they didn't think their plan A would work, as frankly it hadn't. They got beaten 4-0 and 3-0 by Aston Villa this season. So he had to go to something different, and I don't think Derby have got something different. You can say, well, he's got a young squad, he had a little time with them. Well, I don't know if that really holds water. You need to be more tactically flexible. He has learned to be a little bit more flexible, but nevertheless, I think that Frank Lampard needs more time to develop tactical plans. He's got a great backroom staff. Jody Morris, I know that Shay Given is in there as well. There's a lot of football brains in there, albeit relatively inexperienced ones. So he will learn, I think, that there is more to it than just one basic plan. And he will get another plan, I'm sure. And he'll build that Derby team up. He will build that squad to a point where he can find a way to win games that isn't just, we'll play really good football, we'll knock it around well. He's going to need some investment. I think he's obviously going to lose a lot of loan players over the winter, and that's a problem. Over the summer, sorry, and that's a problem. How can he find, is he going to get those same players back? Is he going to be able to go back into the same sort of market? Excuse me. But the other one, I look at those celebrations after the Leeds game. And Lampard was at the forefront of them. And that seems more than reasonable, because he'd been taking a lot of stick before and during the game. But I look at those celebrations and I just think, it's a semi-final. You haven't won this competition yet. You're not back in the Premier League. And I just wonder whether, while Frank Lampard is obviously someone who connects with the players and is very popular with the players, I do wonder whether that makes it difficult for him to be above it, makes it difficult for him to be dispassionate in the wake of a semi-final like that, for all its emotionally charged nature, for him just to say, lads, great, well done, have a couple of beers tonight maybe, but you know, we've got a game in a week's time, and actually we need to start thinking about how we're going to beat a team that's beaten us 7-0 on aggregate this season. I'm not saying it was a mistake of Frank Lampard to celebrate with his players, but when you then go on and get beaten by Aston Villa, you have to wonder whether you've made the right decision to behave in that way after winning what was realistically just a semi-final.
This is Love Sport.
This is my club. I'm the manager of this club with a two-year contract, so that's my only thought. The conversations I'm having with that two-year contract this week will be to see how we can compete again in the Championship next year.
Frank Lampard knows the lines, doesn't he? He's already learned how to say, no, I'm currently this club's manager, without really ruling anything out or anything in. I've no doubt that if Chelsea come calling, he'll find it extremely hard to divert the call. Maybe he should just turn his phone off for, what, a month? Yeah, Frank, turn your phone off, and then there's no chance that anyone can report that you've been in talks with Chelsea. I don't think it'll be a problem because I don't think Mauricio Sarri's going anywhere. I don't think he'll afford to get rid of him. But nevertheless, they'll be back in the Championship next year, and Frank sounds confident that he will be the man leading them in the Championship as well. Let's speak to Mark Edworthy, former Derby defender. Mark, I'm sure you're disappointed, but overall it's been a pretty good first season for Frank Lampard, really, hasn't it?
It certainly has. I think he's done tremendously well to take the club to a playoff final. Unfortunately, on the day, there's going to be someone who loses the game, but a wonderful occasion, great spectacle, two really big clubs, Aston Villa, as we know, great history as well. But there's got to be a loser, and I think we just left it a little bit too late yesterday, but a great effort for the Championship, has been all season, and I think Frank should reflect on a really, really good season and his first year in management.
You've obviously been in a playoff final with Derby and won it, of course. I think did you win it with Palace back in 97 as well? I can't remember if you were there at that time, but you obviously know what it's
actually.
Like. Good, okay. So you're the expert on winning playoff finals. Just tell us a little bit about, because they're such pressurised environments, how do you deal with that as a player?
Well, it's very difficult. You've got to do the preparation the same and just treat it like a normal game. But what happens when you get there and there's 85,000 people there yesterday. I was very fortunate to go there at the old Wembley with the Twin Towers. I lost it the first year against Leicester City when Steve Claris scored that last minute winner, and then we went back the following year and David Hopkins scored that last minute winner to beat Sheffield United. So I've been on both sides of the coin, winner and a loser, and then obviously back in 2007 to win it with Derby. But it's just the occasion. People say about this pitch, really, as a player, I was quite fortunate with fitness and stuff, and it was the only time I ever got cramp at Wembley.
Wow.
And I just think it's the occasion. It's a wonderful spectacle, and don't forget we had some young players on show yesterday, and they'll learn from that as well. So it is very, very difficult not to treat it as any other game. And as we know now, the reward of getting into the Premier League, 170 million Aston Villa will get. Mm-hmm. And then if they manage to stay in the Premiership, which is always also very vital, they get a further 300 million. So financially, it's a massive, massive reward for the winners.
Yeah, and I suppose as a player, it's hard to get away from that. You know, as you say, you try and prepare for every game the same way, but those numbers and all the implications. And you know, also, from a personal perspective, I was speaking to Richard Lee earlier this week, and he was saying that, you know, in your contract, a lot of these guys will have 50 or even 60% wage rises if you get promoted.
Yeah, it is. It affects everything. I think it affects the city. It affects local businesses. And because now that the Premier League is such a global industry now, isn't it? So it does. I think players' salaries do increase. And all of a sudden, then you're a Premier League player. Your status has changed as well.
Yeah.
It's a massive reward on that side. But hopefully the players can learn from that. They've got a taster of it now. And It's very difficult to get out to the Championship as well. It's a very competitive league. We've seen Norwich do it a few times, and obviously Sheffield United, give them great credit for going up as well. And Villa are a big club. As like Leeds United missed out. There's some big, big clubs in the Championship, and that's why it makes it so difficult. And it's so fascinating every season that there's only three that get promoted. But at the start of the season, as soon as those fixtures come out, there's 10 or 12 teams who think they can do it.
Were you surprised by the team that Derby put out yesterday? You know, no Waghorn, no Marriott after his heroics in the semi-final. Were you surprised to see the side that did start?
Well, I think we always, in hindsight, we all think we're managers, don't we? We all think we can pick the starting lineup, and that's a beautiful part of the game. I think the thing with Marriott, he was on such a high from scoring them wonderful goals at Leeds, and whether we thought that Frank was going to keep him as his, you know, lethal weapon to bring him on, because he scored against Chelsea, scored against Man United, he scored in every division. I think Waghorn was struggling with a bit of injury, I think, and obviously we've lost Dwayne Holmes as well. So I think, you know, as a manager, you think that this is my best side, and you do all the tactics for the week. They've looked at the Villa team, and if it works, you're a genius. If it doesn't, you can always say, well, maybe I could have started Marriott, or was it good to bring him on after? You know, it's one of those sort of things. If I wouldn't be speaking to you now if I was in Frank's position, but I think a lot of people just thought maybe Marriott could have started purely because he must have been on such a high from Leeds. Mm. Was he going to continue that? And he certainly did, because he came on and scored the goal. And I just thought we were going to go and equalise and take it into extra time, but it just wasn't to be.
No, so shoulda, woulda, coulda, and it was pretty close in the end. It's a tricky summer now for Derby? Because obviously one of the things that Frank has done, he's brought in three brilliant players on loan. How do you see the squad going forward? How much work do you think there is to do over the summer?
Well, I think what we've done, we've got a wonderful group of players, and you're always going to get speculation now. If you think Harry Wilson, Mason Mount, Tomori, what they've done for their careers this season, their stock has risen for sure because they've had an outstanding season. Jaden Bogart, right back, coming through the academy, wonderful talent. You know, some other clubs are going to look at and speculate that they want those players in their team. Hopefully, if Frank can keep them together, there's going to be speculation with Frank as who he is. It's been talked about all season about the link for Chelsea, you know, probably one of the best midfield players in the world, great servant for Chelsea. So agents are going to chuck things out there, or the press are going to jump on it now because it's that type of that time of the season now. It's the end of the season. Speculation with players all around the country are going to start taking place. But I hope we can you can sit down with the owner and continue this journey he's on. Yes, we probably do need a few more players, and every team does over the course of any season because the Championship is such a tough league.
Mm. You mentioned it's such a tough league, and of course Derby have been so nearly getting out of it on so many occasions over the last 10 years. You must be quite looking forward to perhaps getting an automatic promotion spot next year after all this playoff heartache.
Well, if there's any justice in the game, you'd like to think that. People say to me so many times, say, Mark, yeah, you played at Wembley, you've won it, you've lost. And I was very fortunate to get automatic promotion with Norwich. And believe me, I'd much rather do it straight off and being promoted.
We'll give you two weeks extra holiday for a start.
Well, it's not so much that. I think, as we talked about with the money now, talked about that the pressure on that game. I don't think the players worry about the financial side of it. Honestly, if you asked a player and they said, you know what, this game's worth 170 million. I don't think they reflect on that. You know, professional as they are, they just get on with the game and concentrate on that the particular day. But it affects you so much. And I think when we did win it, it's just that release, it's just you're relieved that it's over and you finally have got promoted. But it still makes it a wonderful spectacle and a wonderful day, providing you win.
Mark, I also just finally want to ask you a quick question because I know obviously we mentioned Crystal Palace a little earlier on and they've got a very fine young right back coming through at the moment who, well, I wouldn't like to compare him to you, but you know, he's decent and he's a right back and he's at Palace. Aaron Wan-Bissaka, his future is up in the air at the moment. Would you forgive him if he said, you know what, I've got to go and play for one of these massive clubs in the Premier League?
Oh, what a player, what an athlete as well. And I think that's if you're doing it regularly in the Premier League like he has been doing. It's very difficult because the big clubs are going to come now. I think even the Premiership, we look at the Premiership now, it's almost broken down into three leagues, isn't it? You've got the Champions League 4, who try to get in there, or the top 6. You've got the middle sector and the other teams, yeah, as we said, with the amount of money involved, just want to keep their status in the Premiership because it's such a financial gain every year just to retain their place in the Premiership. So if you want to win trophies, no disrespect to players, wonderful club, wonderful support. And if he wants to improve on his career, and that's what I think a lot of players want to do as well, even in the Premiership, they want to try to get some silverware. So it's a difficult one. And how do you turn down the big boys? It's very, very difficult. I was not in that position.
but I don't believe that for a second.
No, it's great to see young players really performing in the Premiership. And let's hope he'll make the right decision to hopefully stay at Palace, but if the big boys come along, it's very difficult to turn them down sometimes.
Yeah, I bet. Mark, thank you so much for your time. Very generous of you to come on, as always, and give us your expert insight into the players. I don't think there are many more successful playoff players than Mark Edworthy. Got promoted from the playoffs with Crystal Palace, got promoted from the playoffs with Derby County, also lost a final to Leicester, got automatic promotion from Norwich. I'll tell you what, if you're a manager and you're looking to get promoted next season, maybe just hire Mark Edworthy for the last 3 months of the season.
This is Love Sport.
It's time to talk a little bit about Spanish football and a story that's just sort of evolving as the day goes on. That police in Spain have made a number of arrests as part of an investigation into match fixing. Let's speak to Tom Allnut, Spanish football correspondent for AFP. He's going to be able to expand on this a little bit more. Tom, maybe just fill us in with the bare bones of what we know so far.
Well, basically, an investigation has begun into match fixing in Spain. Essentially, a system has been set up over here where La Liga assess matches, and anything that's suspicious, they pass on to the police. and a match in the last season, that in 2017-18 season, was flagged up as suspicious between Huesca and another club called Nastic. And that basically sparked an investigation, which has prompted the police to believe that actually around possibly even 10 La Liga matches were involved in match fixing. I mean, what we're talking about here is quite possibly not so much the fixing of results, but what we often see in these kind of cases, it's more to do with spot fixing in terms of corners or penalties or throw-ins, that kind of thing. So it will be interesting to see how it plays out. I mean, there are a few players who have been named already, and I mean, not necessarily ones that people would necessarily know, but one of them was Raul Brava, who was once for Real Madrid in Spain, was probably the most high profile of them. So I guess we wait and see what happens in the next few weeks.
Is there any, I mean, I sort of imagine that this has happened before in Spain. Is this, in terms of other investigations or other stramashes about match fixing, is this about as high profile as it's been?
Well, we had one earlier last season as well, where they had a similar investigation came about. I mean, the thing is really is that what you always have, the problem with corruption and match fixing, is you'll have one side that when it gets exposed, you could say on one side of the coin that the investigation and the interrogation is stricter and stronger because you're rooting out the problems, and therefore it's evidence that at least you're tackling the issue. And on the other side, obviously, no one wants to actually see that there is corruption in the game. So La Liga today are sort of claiming this as a victory, you know, that this shows that our systems are working, that we're finding these cases. But obviously, it really comes out as a negative story about Spanish football. But I mean, we've seen here as well in tennis. I mean, there's been a story earlier this year where they found players as well. Again, in sort of lower levels of the game. I mean, it does tend to be with corruption and match fixing. It tends to involve players and clubs who maybe don't earn as much money as the sort of the top level teams and players. So that tends to be the trend. But yeah, it's certainly not the first and probably won't be the last.
No, quite. Let's move on, because obviously there's only so much we can say about that with an ongoing investigation. And I can hear your lawyer sweating as we speak. Let's talk about Barcelona, who there's reports flying around that they could sack Ernesto Valverde today after obviously heartbreaking the Champions League and Copa del Rey. Now, this is becoming a trend, isn't it? And that seems to be what's worrying the Barcelona board, is that a couple of times now they've collapsed in the Champions League.
Well, I mean, it's a trend as well. They've won La Liga with Valverde twice out of two, you know. So, I mean, it depends how you look at it. I mean, the problem the Barcelona have is that they're absolutely obsessed with the Champions League, as are, to be fair, three or four teams in Europe right now. You know, you could say the same of PSG, of Juventus, maybe even Manchester City. Barcelona basically defining their seasons at the moment by winning the Champions League, and that is a very, very high bar to set for any coach, because, as we know, anything can happen in that tournament, you know. And in some ways, Real Madrid winning it three times in a row made it look as though it was a tournament that could be won consistently. And I think Barcelona looked at that and said, well, look, why are we not doing something similar? And in a way, it's been very difficult for Valverde to satisfy that agenda, because it's a very difficult agenda to satisfy. But at the same time, that, you know, they've done well in the league, very, very well. But the nature of the way they've gone out in the Champions League this season and last season was obviously extremely dramatic, extremely raw for the fans, because it's one thing to go out in the semi-final, the final, 1-0 on away goals or something, but to throw away the leads they have, I think it was very difficult to take. And there's also a wider issue with Valverde, where people, fans of Barcelona, have a very specific way that they want the game to be played. They have a very specific idea of the values that a Barcelona coach should be about. And for whatever reason, there's a fairly strong section of the fan base that have never really quite taken to the way that Valverde sets his teams up, and also perhaps his general demeanour. You know, the idea that perhaps you want someone a bit more charismatic, a bit more spectacular in the way they speak in press conferences and things. So perhaps when it comes to going out of the Champions League, and as we saw on the weekend, losing even in the Copa del Rey final, he has slightly less credit in the bank than he might otherwise.
The short list, or well, it's a relatively long list actually, to replace him potentially includes a few names that will be familiar to listeners here. Former Everton boss Roberto Martinez, Ronald Koeman, Max Allegri, of course, has just become available, Unai Emery as well. Do any of those have any credence to you at all?
Well, the one thing we do know about Barcelona is they're not particularly traditional when it comes to looking to their coaches. You know, I mean, if we look at other big super clubs across Europe, you know, they would probably be jumping at a chance to hire Allegri. They might even be looking at Mourinho. They might be looking at Conte, you know, these kind of guys who have big history of success, you know, on their CVs. But Barcelona have tended to look slightly more within, certainly in Spain and even within the club sometimes. And that, again, touches on what we were just talking about just there, about the fact that they really feel they need a certain brand of coach who understands the club, who knows the values of the team and the way they want the game to be played. So I'd be surprised if they went for one of those big names, particularly those three, Allegri, Mourinho and Conte, who, none of whom really play the kind of football that Barcelona look for. Martinez, I mean, I think it would be a surprise to fans in England, but in Spain he has a reputation for certainly playing football in the right way. But I think a lot of people who perhaps Everton fans would maybe say that sometimes it was more style than substance. So it'll be interesting to see. I mean, Koeman obviously has a massive history with Barcelona, but again, his results have been up and down and patchy. So at the moment, there's no standout candidate. Even this morning, for example, Xavi was confirmed as taking over the Qatari club Al Saab. So he was one that maybe people were talking about in a kind of slightly romantic way of coming back and being coach at Barca, a bit like Guardiola, if you like. But he now is off the list as well. So it'll be interesting to see if they do sack Valverde, if it's today or this week, which is increasingly looking more and more likely now. It'll be fascinating to see who they go with next.
Yeah, Barcelona never want to sort of go with the book, are they, as you say there. Tom, thank you very much for coming on and making sure that we don't get sued for libelling anyone over the match fixing. Very, very well done indeed. Tom Olnut there, Spanish football correspondent for AFP. I mean, the upshot of that match fixing thing, as he mentioned, we've seen it with tennis, and it tends to be organised crime with lower-level sports people. At least they're catching them. It's a positive, I suppose.
Love sport.
Anthony Joshua's been talking this week. He's got a fight coming up on June the 1st. He's taking on, well, actually, he can't remember his name, frankly. He barely knows who he's fighting this weekend. He was, of course, supposed to be up against Jarrell Miller. He pulled out after, well, doping a lot, because it's a drugs cheat, of which there are plenty in boxing, so it's not really a problem. And then, of course, he was replaced by Andy Ruiz Jr. And it really sticks in the craw, actually, when Sky Sports, or, you know, anyone else, frankly, whenever they will, as they will repeatedly this week, continue to build up Anthony Joshua's next fight against Ruiz like it's a good one. You know, like it's a challenge. Like this is the next step in AJ's great story. It is a step, and it's a step backwards and down. You know, like when you sort of come up from the basement and see something you're not supposed to see, and you just sort of creep backwards. That's what sort of step this is in Anthony Joshua's career, if you ask me. Because he's taking on a man who really isn't fit to lace up his gloves, quite frankly. Let's compare the two careers, right, shall we? As an amateur, Joshua was a world silver medalist, a GB champion, and then an Olympic gold medalist. Andy Ruiz Jr. won the Mexican National Junior Olympics, whatever that is, I think I might have competed in them once, and then failed to qualify for the 2008 Olympics because he lost to Oscar Rivas, among others. Joshua has won every single one of his 22 professional fights. Only one of those has given the judges any work to do whatsoever. By contrast, Ruiz has gone to the scorecards 11 times in his 32 professional wins, and he's also got one defeat as well. He lost, by the way, to Joseph Parker in 2016. That's the same Parker who couldn't take a round off Joshua in Cardiff back in March last year. So, if you really want to look for an opponent, I don't think Andy Ruiz is that. He's a bloke who will share the ring. I can't take that away from him. And you know what? Matchroom probably love him, because he is going to come and fight. Andy Ruiz is going to do exactly what he's required to do, and that's get knocked out in two rounds. Joshua's fought for a title 7 times in his career, a world title, that is. Ruiz has done it once. It was the WBO, it was vacant, and he lost to Parker. This is not a worthy world title challenger. He's a worthy bloke to stand there with his dodgy goatee and out-of-shape torso and get hit by Joshua quite a lot for about 4 minutes. It's a glorified spar. You really should be able to rely on the fighter himself, by the way. You know, for all I'm talking down this fight, someone's got to talk it up. And you should be able to rely on the fighter himself to talk up the fight. But even Joshua can't talk up his own fight. The name Deontay Wilder has crossed his lips more than Andy Ruiz this month. Last week he says his focus was only on that WBC belt, before adding that, also, and winning that fight against that bloke on June the 1st. Honestly, what's his name? Andy or something. It's pathetic. Even he can't bring himself to say with a straight face and without his fingers crossed behind his back, yeah, I'm really going to struggle against this guy. He's going to give me a really good test, but I'm going to knock him out anyway. He basically forgets to mention it. All he ever talks about is Deontay Wilder. And it's the same for the rest of us. That's what we want to see. Have a listen to Joshua. He was talking to Sky Sports about how to solve the situation of the best fighting the best in the heavyweight division.
They should sit us down face to face. That would be good. I think they should sit us down face to face and talk about what the issues are, man to man, and get this fight sorted this year.
That's not how business is done. Like, you can't just say, oh, well, if we get both of us in the room, we'll get a fight. No, the problem, like, it's all very well to say it. Yeah, just sit us down face to face, man to man, and that'll get it done. Unfortunately, it won't. I think if you put Joshua and Wilder in a room together with a contract and said, this is the fight. If you both sign here, you will fight in 12 weeks' time. And everyone else will sort out the terms, but that's going to happen no matter what. If you did that, I'm sure that they would come out and fight. But the problem is that they are not the only people involved. Joshua and Wilder are happy to fight each other because they know that even if they lose, they will come again and again and again. They have that thing that so many sports people have, which is an unshakable self-belief. They can't ever believe that there will come a time in their lives or their careers where they are not able to sell themselves as fighters. But the people around them are not like that. The people around them are less successful, less driven, have less self-belief, and they are worried about missing out on their big money-making opportunity. That's really what's going on here. The people between Joshua and Wilder are getting in the way of this fight happening again and probably again and probably again. I would watch Joshua Wilder every Christmas, if I could, for the next 5 years, maybe with Fury flown in there as well. And everyone would, and we'd all pay for it. But the people who are going to pay for Joshua versus Ruiz are getting conned. Because it's a rubbish fight. It's not going to be interesting. You're going to see Anthony Joshua crunch a bloke in the chin after 4 minutes and then stand there with his belt around his waist saying, yeah, I'm the world champion, but I want to fight Wilder. We know you want to fight Wilder. Why won't you just do it? Why won't you let it happen? It's not possible for some reason. Who's in the way of this? I want someone to put their hand up and say, I'm delaying this fight. I'm the one that's making sure Joshua and Wilder's not happening. But the problem is they're squabbling. And they're only squabbling over a couple of million dollars, realistically. Both sides are going to make $50 or $60 million out of the first fight. And everything that goes with it. And everything after it. The two men would do it. But their people won't. Please, please, please let them fight. Because there's only so many times I can watch Joshua knock out a fat bloke.
This is Love Sport.
You've been listening to a podcast edition of The James Gray Show. Remember to leave us a rating and a review, but only nice ones. I don't take criticism well.